Hey guys, Will here, just wanting to go ahead and give you a quick announcement about next week's show. And hey, that announcement is that there won't be one. We'll be busy celebrating the American Independence Day. So happy 4th of July to everybody, whether you celebrate it on this side of the pond or I think that we're heathen betraying scum for our British listeners. Regardless, I think we should be back on track pretty quickly after that. We've already got an episode ready to roll for that week that should be a lot of fun. In the meantime, I just want to throw another thank you out to everybody that has been and still is a Patreon supporter. By the time you hear this, hopefully a lot of those rewards are out making it to folks. So I just want to say thank you. That means a lot to be able to have some of that to put towards covering the site and different things, as well as kind of providing some prizes. I've got some other kind of crazy, kind of big plans that I would love to try to tackle. So hey, if you want to help make something totally crazy happen, by all means, jump in and support us on Patreon. Or hey, if you just enjoy the content now that we are back to regularly putting that out, let us know. Even if you can't do that, it would mean a lot to me, guys, if you took a little bit of time to hop on iTunes or Android or something like that to go ahead and leave a rating and a review of our podcast. I would really, really kind of love to see us jump up in some of those rainy ratings and rankings. So jump on it, and I will see you guys after the holiday. The Magnar of Fen studied John with chilly gray eyes. "We shall learn their numbers soon enough," he said after a moment. "Go. I will send for you if I have further questions." Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast. Founded in 2010 as Two Champs and a Chump, we thought it best to rename and rebrand ourselves freshly just in time for the game to keep the same in the second edition. Tune in each week for your dose of strategy, discussion, jokes, and good old geek culture. A huge thank you goes out to GRRM for his amazing novels, FFG for this fantastic game, Card Game DB for getting us a start, and you, our loyal listeners, for sticking through thick and thin. Check us out on our website, Facebook, or Twitter, or email us at contact@whitebookpodcast.com and rate us on iTunes. This CC licensed music is Town Function by Spinners. Really scraping the bottom of the barrel for quotes here. You know, that just doesn't have the punch of "there are no men like me," but yeah, I at least thought it was fitting for the episode.
Have you ever thought about doing like a quote sequel, kind of like they do in Hollywood? You know, like, you know it's gas, you might as well use it twice, right?
You know, not intentionally.
Who is this voice?
Oh, this is the voice of Alex Black back again.
There we go.
You would know when truly on episodes.
Back in black.
I was going to say, in case y'all didn't know, because I haven't been on in a while, I'm also back as well, and I'm Luke. Slops to me for missing, or props, in case you don't like me being on here.
Who doesn't like you being on here? You're not Aaron Glazer.
I feel like it's probably a mixed bag.
Folks love you, Luke. They just don't like your radiator.
Yes. Luke, I can say, like, having gone to a bunch of events recently and talked to, like, fans of the show, everyone is so much happier now that you're not next to a 747 when you're recording. So, like, I actually had listeners come up to me and be like, we really like, I was like, well, what do you think of the different hosts? And like, we really like Luke, particularly now that he is not in you know, JFK runway. So I don't worry about that. Now you're easily like there's like Will, and then you're easily in the like right below Will tier of hosts. If like Aaron's at the bottom,
wow, that is really community. Not where you want to be.
Will is Will, right? Will's the founder, right? So everyone loves Will. Then Glazer's the bottom, right? The infamous community destroying Aaron Glazer. So you're like one step below Will, probably.
And see, this is the worst part, because like having talked to Alex just the little bit that I have here before the show, I feel like all four of us are just like in this constant battle to self-deprecate ourselves to the bottom.
It's true. So true.
But here's the thing. Aaron sets the bottom so low, it just keeps moving and moving and moving and moving. Like,
we can't dig ourselves down there fast enough.
Right, because every time Aaron sticks his head up, he's like, oh, not deep enough. Keep digging.
Hold on, let me say something else shitty about some other people who are really popular.
Wow, this might be the greatest stuff I've ever heard Roy say. I love it.
What a way to start.
Definitely a banner intro. Yeah, this is much better than the intro that you, me, and Aaron did when we reviewed the last pack.
Yeah, I know, because you talk crap about me. So this is only revenge
actually,
for you calling me milk toast. So
whatever, man. The best intro was when I just made joke after joke after joke about Patrick Haynes being a little kid, and then Will cut it all.
That was so good. Like,
hey, I dropped some of those in the Easter egg, didn't I?
Yeah, but nobody listens to that shit.
That's true.
To be fair, that was only because Patrick, you know, made fun of me in the previous episode, so we went at him in the following episode. So it's just that's just the way it goes. This is how this white book host comes. I'm sure Aaron will give me a hard time next time we're on in separate episodes, or he'll probably give me a hard time next time we're on episode together, because that's just how Aaron.
That's
is.
True.
So it's just a cycle to entertain listeners.
It's brotherly love, you know. It expresses itself in. Different
hey, Roy's
ways.
In the city of brotherly love.
I am.
Yeah.
It not only expressed itself as brotherly affection, but also increases my shrink bills. So it just really is the gift that keeps on giving.
You're just putting that money back into the economy, Roy.
Yeah, Aaron is a job creator with his insults.
So, the best of both worlds, really.
It really is.
Man, I hope that Aaron listens to this. I doubt he will, but I hope he does, because that was golden.
Yeah, that was.
Does he even listen to episodes that he's on?
He'll listen occasionally. It's very random when he listens to episodes. Like if it's like, I think he might listen to this one because of what Luke has prepared. This is the kind of thing Aaron's interested in. But so he may actually hear this.
Well,
you mean all the research I did?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't think at this point that the banter is going to go up from the earlier heights we attained. So I think we should go ahead and jump into our first topic, which is something that Luke has been kind of champing at the bit to discuss for a while here. So I apologize to listeners that by the time you listen to this, it's like a month after the events in question. But I wanted to give Luke the chance to get his case before us. So, all right, what's the rant, Luke?
Okay. Apologies in advance, all you listeners. I was moving into a new house and couldn't be on the episode when they actually talked about it. But so I don't have a problem with like any of the U.S. Nationals like tournament or structure or like location or anything. I just have a problem with the way that the community has kind of reacted to the point where, and I know that Patrick did an amazing job and Alex did an amazing job. And by the way, I heard the team event was awesome, Alex. So heard
it was. I look forward to having you play in it someday.
Yeah, if I can get out there.
Well, it might not to derail you, but it might not just be stuck in Seattle. So we might be looking to take that show on the road, so to speak.
Fair enough. I mean, so leading up to Origins, and Roy, you were on all of the Second Sons episodes leading up to Origins, and you know how bad everybody talks shit about that tournament. And, like, everybody built up this amazing hype, and Patrick did an amazing job of doing PR and reaching out to all of the local metas that he could and providing all of the tournament support and prizes that he could. And the Road to ETX events were awesome. and then Nationals turned up, and like the turnout was a little lower, but I think Alex and I agree that I think that's mostly a reflection of not just the particular like odd timing of Nationals, but also like where the game is at the moment. And I'm not really going to harp on that too much, but then like all I'm saying is that if that were Origins, people would have lost their minds. Everybody was calling it a joke. Everybody was saying it's not a real tournament in to begin with. And then like, and then we have another tournament that's of the same caliber, in my opinion, and had an amazing champion. And, like, I really love Seth. Seth's a good friend. I met him at Origins last year, actually. And that's where we really became friends. But, like, when Nate won, I think people were happy because they know Nate. But I don't think anybody thought of it as a real tournament, that nobody ever thought of that as Nationals. Part of that's FFG's fault. But I just wonder why, like, all the veterans are protecting this event and not, like, you know, levying a little bit of criticism at the fact that, like, you know, it wasn't as well attended. And quite frankly, there were a couple errors that didn't get nearly the press that if something would have happened at Origins, it would have got.
I mean, if I could just jump in, I'm sure the other guys have more reasons than me, but I think
because I'm sure everybody will address the other things. So that'll be the end. Yeah. I'm sorry, Will.
Oh, no, that's okay. I was just going to say, I think the one primary one that kind of sealed the deal for me was kind of intention. Like, I feel like the community kind of looking at the event and the organization process and stuff, it, like you said, could see the dedication that Patrick was putting into things and how much he was trying to get the community involved and to kind of rep things and put ads out there and kind of craft a Road to Nationals kind of experience and like went above and beyond as far as effort goes compared to Origin. Yeah, that's pretty much it, is just that difference in effort I think people respect.
I agree, and I think that if FFG had let us folks in the Midwest who were close to the situation do what Patrick was able to do, because Patrick has a close relationship with them that's pre-existent, then I think we would have put on a much better show. And
I agree with that.
And like, so I don't know that argument holds a whole lot of water, because nobody gave us a chance, because it was all FFG from the very beginning. Nate French was there, for God's sakes.
Right. Okay, so Alex, unless you would you like to go next, or
because I have no problem letting you go if that's if you feel okay. Strong.
Because yeah. I think Luke. I mean, I definitely get where Luke is coming from, because Origins was definitely much more poorly received, even though it was what 20, 25 people larger. Maybe I'm thinking it might have even been bigger than that, right?
It was 84 players.
84, so 30 more players, right? Or 30 more, roughly 30 players.
30-ish,
right? And I think no one really downplayed, I think, Nate being the U.S. champion, because like I remember at Gen Con, people were coming up to Nate, and I include myself among this, like congratulating him. We weren't at Origins, and we're saying, well deserved, Nate, because it was like a big win for Nate. And I think everybody thought that his win was legitimate, and it was a real tournament in that sense. Like the person who won, or the person who people who broke at Origins, like got credit for the people who were sort of knew who they were. But I think the real reason why Origins was so poorly received has everything to do with Gen Con. And I know that's why in particular the Beyond the Wall hosts like John and Sean and the Second Sons people, myself, Aaron and Chris Schoenthal, who later went on to become Gen Con champion, and myself, we didn't know what FFG's attitude towards Gen Con was. And the initial announcement of Origins made it seem like the long-term goal of FFG was to move, you know, Nationals/Continentals from Gen Con over to Origins. And so many of us had already planned our entire year of Competitive Thrones around Gen Con.
Yeah.
And Gen Con is the oldest traditional home of Thrones at this point. Many old-timers, I know when I was starting getting heavily into the community in 2014, and, you know, I came in after Gen Con, but people are like, Gen Con is great. Gen Con, if you want to take this seriously, Gen Con should be your target goal, even more than Worlds. Gen Con is where the North American players really come together. It's an amazing event. Then in 2015, I went, and it was one of the best experiences of my life. You know, 2016, same thing, right? And you know, But so people were naturally protective of that experience. And the fact that FFG was making noises behind the scenes and in their announcements that that relationship could be changing freaked a lot of longtime players the fuck out. And that led to degrading Origins. I don't think anyone holds how Origins ended up being towards the Midwest people. Cause again, Midwest also had Gen Con and I think it was just simply.
All I'm saying is that Aaron Broderick and Seth Lowe and Sandy Barnabas were also all at Origins last year. I don't know, man. I don't think that that necessarily holds up because even if it moved from Gen Con, the experience at Origins is super comparable if they decided to move it, because Indianapolis and Columbus are essentially the same.
I agree with you, Luke, in the sense that, from an objective point of view, that's the case. But this is not an objective question. This is a question of sentiment and emotion, right? The reason why...
Then why didn't NYC show up at Nationals? Why didn't the Coastal people show up?
Because literally, none of us... I couldn't afford to go. I had a choice between Origins and Gen Con. And I decided What? This year? Wait.
Yeah, I mean, to Seattle. If everybody was all hyped about it, why didn't
because,
they go?
Because it's in Seattle. That's the key. It's that simple. And Sandy and some East Coasters went. You want specifically to know why Origins was treated the way it wasn't. The way it was. And that's what my answer is. It's FFG didn't hammer out clearly this new Nationals Continental system. And that now that it is, all the old timers, myself included, are perfectly okay with Nationals being anywhere. Have gone back to Origins. It could have stayed at Origins.
I need to be clear. I'm not biased just because I live close. I actually think the West Coast needs and deserves a big time premier event. So just putting that out there.
Again, but Luke, I want to make sure you're making my point clear. The reason why Origins was reacted to the way it was has everything to do with the way FFG screwed up the rollout of their new OP system.
I guess
tournament itself
too.
And Origins was just a victim of that. Is what I would say.
Yeah, but okay. It wasn't just Origins. It was the entire Midwest player base. Right. Sorry, Alec.
No, it's okay.
Can Luke expand upon that? You feel like the entire Midwest player base was insulted by
100%. Yes.
I mean,
100%.
I mean, that was never my
No, not by you.
This year or last year or when exactly?
When all of the Origin stuff was going down.
Gotcha.
I remember specifically on that episode of Second Sons, really. And I remember in posts in the Facebook group. And I remember people talking about the fact that, literally the only people that they knew that were going were Sandy and me. And they were just talking about that and da 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 da. And lo and behold, Nate Tarantelli, an amazing player, and Chris Thompson, amazing player. The people were there, you know? And a lot of folks from Indy and Ohio have rallied around that and said, you know what? At big tournaments, we're gonna take this down. We're gonna figure this out. We're gonna show some of these guys that that's not the case anymore. That we're not nobodies. And
yeah,
I do have to agree. I remember hearing that same kind of general derision from the community that hey, it's just a bunch of Midwest rubes. Nobody that matters is gonna be there. I definitely remember that.
Mm-hmm. I mean that's probably true. I mean I remember Aaron making a lot of jokes about flyover country, but My attitude. Yeah.
Sorry, Alex.
I'm going to say this though. I think the problem that the Midwest community had in the early part of the Thrones, 2.0, was your ambassadors were not the best ambassadors towards East Coast folks and West Coast folks, and the people who got people. There was Joe from Cincinnati, and then another group of people, and everyone Joe.
You mean the other Ohio guys?
The other Ohio guys, right? And, there's been a lot of change over time with the Ohio guys' attitudes, but certainly in 2015, 2016, they didn't leave the best impression on a lot of East and West Coast people, and that definitely didn't help Ohio and the Midwest's reputation.
Yeah, but the Thompsons have been playing Thrones for a long time.
I mean, to be honest, I don't think people lumped the Thompsons in with those guys. They just thought they were the Thompsons.
Yeah.
Okay. So
but anyway, now we're in the weeds.
So every quagmire, there are a lot of factors to take into account when you try to completely analyze the origins aftermath, or even, you know, what happened beforehand. I didn't go to Origins, so I can't speak directly to the experience there. But what I can say is that, from what I remember, there didn't seem to be much in the way of communication from FFG with the community, with the Midwest community. And I think part of that is that Patrick, with ETX at least, reach out to FFG to make these changes. And it's one of those things where, you know, given the opportunity, I agree with you. I think that the Midwest community could have put on a really awesome experience, right? I have no doubt about that. But like Roy said, the public perception of Origins and what it meant to Thrones as a community, people were worried about where it stood with Gen Con. And Patrick did such a good job. I'm going to keep jumping around here, but with ETX, Patrick did such a good job with the PR on that, that it just – he really kind of got out in front of any of the potential negative energy around the event and was able to sort of, sidestep some of that, I think, with the Road to Nationals events and things like that. I remember specifically that people complained about the prize support for Origins. Do you guys remember that as well?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So,
well, I actually went to Origins and it was as bad as advertised.
It was. Okay. And and I think we can probably agree it was because it was left to the hands of FFG and FFG alone, right? Probably.
Yeah,
I mean, if ETX had just given out the playmats and the power tokens and the Jamie alt arts, like, people would probably have complained equally as much about ETX as they had about Origins. But Patrick made sure to give a flight to the champion to go to World is Worlds or General? I can't remember. Either way, a flight to the champion to go to Worlds, I believe it is. And he also commissioned an additional playmat, and there were all the Road to events where basically he's giving out free entry to the event all across the country. I think that did a lot to keep ETX out of the hot seat, so to speak.
Dude, Alex, I think that, like, no matter if National stays at ETX in Seattle or not, if it moves somewhere else, people will still call it the Road to ETX. I think that that's almost cemented.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I just, I know that it's that he put a lot of effort into it, and the thing is, he consulted with a lot of the community's more vocal members to make sure they were on board to make it a good event, whether they were going or not. And I think that's part of why you have a lot of people who've sort of championed it. I think you're right, though. Origins probably got a really an undeservedly bad rap, but it had bad PR. From the get-go, it seemed like it was going to compete with Gen Con. It had bad prize support. And, I mean, it doesn't help when you have members of the community who are deriding it from the get-go, basically, you know, just because of where it's at, and maybe there isn't, like, a super strong meta. I mean, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but, like, the Pacific Northwest, or specifically the Seattle meta, is not really wasn't really a national player before this, but we put six people into the top 16 and we had a guy in the finals. And it's like, so, you know, sometimes you just need that opportunity. And I know for a fact there are a ton of excellent players in the Midwest. And it's just, yeah, it's unfortunate that it got the rap it did. And I know this year Origins had a handful of tournaments, but there wasn't a large turnout there. And that's unfortunate. It's too bad that it can't still be, you know, a large tournament, even though it wasn't Nationals this year.
And I think that that's also the same thing. Like, if we were able to organize it, then it would still be a thing.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, like I said, Will, I kept it short. That was all I wanted.
Okay. Well, that sounds reasonable. Did you guys have any other pressing points on that matter you wanted to hit on?
We could probably, I mean, I have a lot more to say.
Wait, you mean
we could go for hours.
Go down the judging rabbit hole, or
Yeah, okay, well, that's fair.
I do think that, you know, if Nationals is at ETX next year and the American community at large hasn't taken another hit like it has this year to the likes of Destiny and other games where I do think we've lost a significant number of players, we're kind of past that honeymoon stage in the game where you have a lot of new players and a lot of those people have left or not playing nearly as much. And if the community stabilizes, I do think that it can grow if Nationals is at ETX next year, because I do think that Patrick has really laid the groundwork for something really cool. So I would be fully in support of making Origins, you know, a tournament worth traveling to for people outside of the Midwest. I don't really know what needs to happen in order to get it there, but I completely agree with you, Luke. Like it got a bad rap, undeservedly so, for a lot of reasons. And I personally respected Nate's win there, and I looked at a lot of those lists that came out of that tournament, and they went into a lot of the testing that we did for Gen Con. So, I mean, it mattered to me. I don't know how it mattered.
Well, and
how,
Will, you can speak to this too. Like Origins is a historically significant site for Thrones as well.
Yeah, isn't it the site of literally the very first Thrones tournament?
Yeah.
Or was it Gen Con when it launched?
I feel like it was Origins. I mean,
that's what I'm thinking, but the launch year was before I started traveling to stuff. So, and plus it was in 2002, so my memory's a little fuzzy.
Oh, and we could go down the rabbit hole of the best of three final, but yeah. I mean, apparently it wasn't announced until the start of the top 16 cut.
So I can say, I mean, having been there, that is correct that it wasn't announced before the tournament, but it was, as in like verbally, like it wasn't announced before the tournament began, but it was knowledge that had been referenced before the tournament. So I think they could have done a better job of vocalizing that. And I mean, I'm a little biased here, as if it had not been a best of three, my meta mate Jim Hansen would have won potentially if Seth could have played differently in game one, potentially. We don't have to go there, but I think it was best for the game for it to be the best of three, even if they didn't, you know, it was a little unscrupulous, I guess you could say.
I'm not opposed to it being best of three in the final. I'm opposed to it being announced the day of the event. There is absolutely no reason why if the like head TO or if FFG were considering like making this a guinea pig and experimenting, why it wouldn't be like made public knowledge either on the Twitter account or in a news article or something. There's just no reason for that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was an oversight.
So that's my last little bit.
Well then, in that case, let's go ahead and kick it on over to something a little different. We've got some pretty big news from FFG that came out this week. We've got a brand new preview article announcing the next box for the game. The next deluxe expansion. There we go. And it's going to be for House Tyrell. And I have to say, I
needed it most, of course.
This is maybe Martell.
I mean, this is going to...
No, I was being facetious.
This is going to be, like, not necessarily a popular opinion with you, Will, but I think this is like Martell is definitely a better suggestion, or Barra. Like, Barra is so desperately in need of a box to do something else.
Okay. But can we agree that like they might not have the clairvoyance necessary to make these decisions months ahead of time?
That's true. No,
no, that's not true, because Nate even said they test a year in advance.
Well, sure. That's what I'm saying. Like,
yeah,
they test a year. Yeah, that's what you, I'm saying. Yeah, they I guess we might be agreeing with one another. I think that they, you know, if this was, if say, let's say that there was a different order that they had in mind, like said, let's say it was whatever the order that people thought it was going to be, where it was Baronex. I don't know what that was based off of, but that seemed to be a common
theory,
their release articles. There we go. So if we're making the assumption that they changed the order based on where the meta was at, you know, a year ago, if that was when the decision was made, Tyrell was in a pretty tough spot, you know, and people were clamoring for better Tyrell cards, this, that, and the other. And so this is this could potentially be a result of that. Now, obviously, the things have changed, and Tyrell's arguably one of the top four factions. And, you know, I just don't think there's a perfect way for them to do that. And I don't know if there's a whole lot that we can gain out of arguing over whether or not it's the right time for the Tyrell box, really.
Well, yeah, I think also, though, like, I think Nate can say what he wants, but it's pretty clear when they chose the Lannister box to go second that, like, I think when they picked the Lannister box, it was so clear that the first cycle was going to be very Lannister favored. So it's clear that they don't really take metagame balance considerations. They take financial considerations. Like, the Stark box makes perfect sense. It made perfect sense both in the sense of what the core set was
why
like.
Why wouldn't Targ be next?
Well, that's what I'm more confused about. Like, I thought Targ was going to be next because
do you think
Danny,
it's possible?
Like a new Danny? Like a new, like all the
grown up dragons?
Yeah.
Is it possible, which we got to get those soon, but is it possible that the Stark and the Lanny box were locked in right at release?
Well, probably. I mean, it's possible. I mean, it's also.
I think Stark probably was for sure.
I think it's just market research, which I think. The fact that Tyrell could be considered more financially viable than the other factions is a really interesting thing to me about where FFG's market research is going and like what the show
people
is
people really love Marjorie.
People really love Marjorie, and they love the Queen of Thorns, right?
Like,
yeah.
So I'm imagining there's going to be a new Queen of Thorns. You know, there's a new mace, or our first mace, right?
That mace.
That mace. Like, I just – I'm not
– He scares me.
I'm really not interested, to be completely honest, in like, I'm obviously going to buy the Tyrell box, but I'm not particularly interested in it. Like, I'm like, oh, okay, they announced this.
Not going to buy Red Wine Straits, no.
No, not going to buy that box. I mean, I bought the Lannister box, so, I mean, that must mean that.
Yeah, because it had clansmen in it. It was awesome.
Yeah.
This is going to be awesome. These are, a couple of these cards are some of the most inventive cards I've seen so far in Thrones. I mean, and a couple others are just...
Which ones?
Reprints or huge power levels, but
which ones do you think?
Are we headed that way into talking about these? I mean, to me, the inventive ones are Mace Tyrell and the Hightower. Mace seems obviously, or to me anyway, very Magic the Gathering inspired with what's affectionately known as a blink mechanic. Yeah. Over there. Maybe we'll come up with some sort of Thronesian suggestion here, but I mean, it's a combo sort of card. What kind of tricks can you come up with? Yeah, I think he's both. And the Hightower, I think, is also a little bit of a combo thing. And I don't know, you guys, well, I know Alex has dabbled in this because we were talking about it earlier. Does the Hightower not seem to you like a Netrunner-inspired card? It does to me for some reason. I can't put my finger on why.
Never played Netrunners.
So this is the one that when you play a Tyrell character, you draw a card or gain a gold?
Yeah.
Is that right?
No, it's after a Tyrell character enters play under your control.
Okay, right.
So it could be put in with Ambush or the Queen of Thorns or something.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it does have some resemblance to some Netrunner cards, but I think that it's definitely limited in its combo-ness based on the once per phase aspect, but it's got a lot of potential. I mean, drawing cards is still good in this game, and I will definitely be playing around with this card. I think the card in that's spoiled in the box that I have talked the most about, though, is the new agenda, the Maester agenda, which we've gotten the result of the Battle of the Trident. Is anyone else just underwhelmed with this card?
A little bit.
I think it's a lot better than y'all think.
So I guess I just wish that you drew the card instead of putting it on top. But I mean, I'm definitely going to try to make it work. I mean, I think that it really depends on what maesters they print in this box. If they print a bunch of really strong maesters, then the must play 12 maesters thing isn't such a detriment. But I think right now it's kind of difficult unless we have some beefy 5-cost, 6-cost maesters, which I assume they're going to have to print some of those. I don't know. That's the one that pulls me in the most of the cards that have been spoiled. But yeah, Mace.
I like Garland.
No, Garland's very strong. Yeah, oh, I just. Yeah. Claim raising effects are always good, right? I mean, these are – the Marjorie is solid as well. The fact that
– Marjorie is awesome.
The first edition version, I mean, didn't they have to control a queen or a lady to have for her to get +1 strength for each defending character or something weird like that?
I believe you're right.
Yes. So, yeah. I think the Strangler also has some potentially interesting uses. So
it does.
Yeah, and I'm always almost. Yeah, that's true.
It's important to note that set means that the strength cannot be modified.
Right. Yeah. But it's no burn. Yeah. So I mean, it makes it so you're immune to burn. You can almost use it offensively in that sort of narrow situation. But I think that the most interesting cards out of the boxes, you know, usually there's a handful of the cards for the faction that's released, but there's always a bunch of good neutrals and a bunch of good cards printed for other factions. And so I'm interested to sort of see as we get those. Do we think Red Wine Straits is just straight up replacing the Arbor?
Yeah, I was about to say, like, we've talked about all this cool combo stuff that's kind of expanding Tyrell or neutral options, but like, the most efficient econ card in the game, maybe?
It's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, half the price of the Arbor for 2/3 of the effect. That seems
so
pretty
much
good
more setup friendly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it seems good. Will, do you have any opinions on these cards? Or not Will, I'm sorry. Oh. Roy. I mean, Will's been talking. I meant Roy. We haven't heard from him in a while.
I think, except for Mace and the agenda, I find all these cards, well, no, Hightower's just boringly dull. Like, I mean, it's just every Tyrell card deck is going to run this. Like, why wouldn't you run Hightower?
I don't know if I would run it in current,
like rush, excuse me, like hard rush.
Yeah,
wouldn't,
because you don't even play Arbor in that deck, really.
Right. Hard rush wouldn't do it. But like more like any other, like, it's just so good. Like, you just play a character and you get a card in gold.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's good that they're printing it, because I do feel like Tyrell's kind of boxed into this sort of rushy, like, the top tier Tyrell decks right now are Tyrell Crossing, Tyrell Wolf. I mean, they're mostly like rushy Tyrell decks, and I think it's good that they're getting some other play in some of the other areas of the triangle, so to speak.
Right. They're just, I mean, there's the danger that Tyrell's just going to become Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
That's
I'm okay with that.
That's my thing, is I feel like Tyrell is now at critical mass of efficient bodies with multiple icons and renown with economy.
Yeah,
so yeah.
It's just Lannister. Like,
exactly.
Does that,
the rich man's Lannister.
Does that seem weird to anyone else? Like, this article specifically mentions early on in it, like, oh, the Tyrells are just the second richest house in Westeros. They're not going to be unseating Lannister on that throne or something along those lines. And I'm like, are you sure?
Well, and the thing is, I will say, the reason I like Garland so much is that, like, Tyrell has so much draw. And I love the idea of ditching a card that you have that's expendable. Like, I love that mechanic.
Yeah, I think he's probably one of those cards, though. Like, I just wish he had a keyword.
Yeah.
I think it's easily the most accessible claim raising effect we have other than Winter is Coming. So, I mean, you know, a lot of the other ones are more circumstantial, and if you're playing a Tyrell Knights deck, you're going to be able to use his action, and it's going to be good in a lot of scenarios. So
I hope positive attachments make a real resurgence, because Marin Heat is really, really good with
him. I think the Conclave is an interesting card. I think particularly for factions like Martell and Stark that are kind of like push towards fealty, or maybe a banner if you want to do something really specific. But if you just want to kind of run a mono deck, they're kind of pushed towards that. And they both have sort of maesters that you want to run. Like, you want to run Maester Luwin because he makes your good Stark cards better. And you want to run Maester Caliote because, or Caliote, or however you want to pronounce it, it's because he's just a good card, right? And being able to import Cressen into those decks, I mean, Martell cares a little less, but Stark loves Cressen. Like, no milks Aemon on my rob. Yeah, no more. You know, it's just... is, and like Aemon, like there's like enough, like kind of just put them in your deck and maybe and try to use this deck thinning as a form of card advantage, which I think Stark actually probably likes a lot. So I'm kind of actually immediately interested in doing something Stark Conclave-y, particularly because that two cost Maester can draw any attachment, right? It's attachment or Maester, right? So the ability to pull ice off that is nice. And things like that. So I think I immediately am going to turn to Stark with that agenda. So.
Yeah. Luke, do you think that this is a well balanced agenda?
No. Because okay. I think that it's I think it's super variance heavy. I think it's super swingy. Like, I hate to see the day when you play against Lani Conclave. When they print a bunch of neutral maesters and a bunch of other non-loyal maesters, or even more Lannister maesters, because, you know, in the books, they're on the Iron Throne, so, I mean, they're going to get maesters.
There's no Qyburn yet.
Right, yeah. And, well, he may not have the maester trait.
Yeah.
He had a maester trait in first edition, didn't he?
He did.
It depends on how thematically, like, adherent they want to be. I don't
a maester, always a maester.
I guess. Like, I don't like it because it just, it creates this scenario where, like, Lani good stuff plus a few maesters gets to be playing with a 50 card deck with a 3 card flop.
See,
with,
I don't
with I, all of with essentially a sideboard. I don't this, like I,
if
I,
this
I,
card I, is if this card is good, it's not going to be good in a fair deck. I think this is going to be a combo card if such a combo exists. Like, this is a combo enabler. Like, it just gives you access to more cards, and if you and in a deck where you can assemble assemble a set of them to win the game, this seems like it's going to further that game plan.
I think I agree though, but I at the same time I feel like a Tywin Shed setup is just as good in Conclave as it is in anything else. And if you're here to serve turn one, you're still playing with 5 gold and a maester on the board.
Yeah, I think it's going to go in faction. It's going to go in Tyrell and Lannister, because Tyrell and Lannister are the most bullshit factions, and it's going to be clear based on, like, you can just pick an agenda, I think, by this point, particularly with Redwine Straits. Like, come on, that is, like, the ultimate bullshit economy card. You know, you just pick an agenda that you think is interesting, and you can make it work because you have a lot of bullshit cards. That's
what's interesting about those factions as well, and Targaryen now too, is that like they can run a bunch of like 1x of key uniques and still have redundancy with house themes.
I don't think Targ is quite there yet.
It's not quite there, but it's pretty close. Their cost curve is pretty diversified. I just did a bunch of research on this.
I was that's dangerously segue. Like the next topic.
I don't think they'll play Conclave, but it is interesting because like
they have no
the worry is that you have key cards shoved underneath your house card, right? But if you have houses that can run a wide range of stuff and still be good, that scares me.
I think Conclave, like the reason why I'm drawn to Stark is because Stark has awkward draw. Like unless you're running plots, it has gates, which is great, but you have to see gates and you don't want to run 3 gates, and you know, it's just sometimes and you can just end up not able to draw
it has
cards.
Fourth and North, Roy.
Right, it's true. It has Fourth and North, the best card ever. But so just the ability to add a supplemental, it's not draw, but supplemental card quality control in Stark to push dead uniques away to, you know, oh, an ice ended up there, like an ice. And because it also synergizes, of course, with the draw card that Stark has, right? Because you put the good card on the top of your deck, trigger gates, draw that card immediately, right? I think it's either going to go in bullshit good stuff decks or decks that Martell or Stark that want supplemental draw, supplemental card quality tools that don't, and deck thinning is just straight up good, right? You always want to be able to run fewer cards than the minimum because that gets you an advantage on your opponent to see the key pieces you need. So I think that's where you're going to see it. I don't, the way it is right now, because you don't have any control over what goes in the sideboard, I don't think it's actually going to be a combo enabler, but I'm happy to be wrong if it is.
I think, I guess I look at, there was a Netrunner, to draw sort of a comparison to a different game, there was a Netrunner ID they printed recently that is basically this exact thing, and it was a combo enabler that won at U.S. Nationals this year. So I guess maybe I'm drawing that comparison because there's sort of a direct correlation.
That's a great
comparison,
Alex. Informative.
Yeah, it did ostensibly the same thing. I mean, it put, I think it was 6 cards on the bottom. The decks are slightly smaller in Netrunner, but, and then you could, it was a little easier to access those cards. I think you could just, like, use an action to get one of them. I can't remember exactly, but I think this will be largely dependent on how many good Maesters they print in this box as far as its utility, like, immediately. Ultimately, like, they're going to print good neutral Maesters, right? That's just going to happen eventually. Yeah. So, it's just a matter of time. Like, this could be a sort of a slower, it could be slower on the uptake, but I think it's, to me, right out of the gate, I kind of wish you would draw the card instead of putting it on the top, but then again, this could be just fine, so we'll see. Definitely going to be brewing with it, though, that's for sure.
Okay. Well, I think that's as good a time as any for us to go ahead. We alluded to the next topic earlier, so let's go ahead and jump into it. This is something that was kind of inspired by the episode that we did for new players last week, where we spent some time talking about kind of deck construction ratios and the like. But kind of realized while talking about it that a lot of that was kind of anecdotal experience. Like when I build a deck, in a lot of ways, it's a lot like how I cook at home. And for those of you that are not aware of this, I drive my wife insane when I cook because I just kind of do it all by intuition and taste. I rarely follow a recipe exactly, and I rarely write it down when I cook something we like. So I'm just not very exact. So we thought it might be fun and interesting to actually take some more granular looks at how things are looking in the game and what folks that are winning are doing. So I did a kind of abbreviated mock-up Excel sheet here, and I know Luke delved down much further than that. But to give you guys just the broad overview, I just went to ThronesDB, and I pulled all of the decks that were listed as winning an event within the last month. So it is admittedly a small sample size, but I think overall, once I started looking at this, there's really not as much variation in a lot of these totals as I was expecting. You know, some basic stuff like folks are sticking to that 60 card count most of the time, aside from a couple decks that ran 61. The character count admittedly surprised me, though, with an average coming in just shy of 33 characters, 32.8. You know, I feel like all of us last week had all said we were running higher than that, maybe kind of using 35 as our guideline. Does that?
I think I was the low guy, but yeah, I was still probably higher than 32.
Yeah.
And I ran the numbers and did a standard deviation on character counts, and the mean of all the means was 32. and the standard deviation was less than one. So,
yeah.
So yeah. 32 seems to be the sweet spot.
I think there's something to be said. I mean, last week was the new player episode. It might be a safer bet for newer players to play a higher character count than that. And I think we added that caveat. I can't recall exactly, but I think
so.
The more technical a deck gets, the less characters you can run, just because, you know, you have a better grasp of how to manage your assets in that scenario, where sometimes when you're a newer player, you kind of need more characters to not just lose the game. I don't know if that makes any sense, but in my head it does.
Yeah, I think so. Just to keep having bodies on the board, to keep doing things and making challenges, even if gameplay kind of goes south for you.
Right. I think the numbers, we were pretty close on a lot of these numbers. I mean, attachments and events, we kind of combined those. It looks like the average is about 13.
Well, I actually did a non-setup column after attachments and events.
Yes.
So that I totaled anything. You know, some attachments, like Bodyguard, was extremely common in these decks.
It's everywhere, right?
So I count that as a setup card. That is something you can play on setup. But non-setup is running just barely over 11 total cards in these decks, which I believe were 16 decks in this sample size. So
yeah, I guess, are there any big surprises with the numbers on the... I'm looking just at the Google sheet that you have here, Will. Were there any major surprises in these statistics? I think that's the characters are a little lower than we expected, maybe.
Yeah, I think maybe income, like limited cards, was much more exacting than I was expecting. I mean, when you look at that, it comes in at 8.4 for an average, but that was pulled down pretty hard by two Night's Watch decks,
right,
that were in the mix. If you discount the Night's Watch decks, it's almost exactly 9.
Yep.
For every deck.
Yep.
That's what I have too.
Yeah, which is just interesting to me. I feel like we did debate some last week about not only the non-setup cards, but also how limited factors into that, because drawing multiples of them effectively turns them into non-setup cards. I would say, admittedly small sample size, but I would say that maybe the number of limited cards has been solved, and that answer is 9.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, if you run a hypergeometric distribution on it, I mean, it's 9 is pretty much the sweet spot.
Yeah, I mean, there are going to be decks that only like that eventually will play less than that for reasons, but I just I think right now 9 is perfect unless you're playing Night's Watch. And
you mean like the Night's Watch Builders Kings of Summer deck?
Yeah, I mean, there. Yeah, that's
Brandon's gift.
Yeah, Brandon's gift. I just non-limited econ. They'll be printing more of it, and as the game progresses, you'll be needing to rely on the limited econ less and less. But for now, 9's the perfect number unless you're playing a Night's Watch deck. So. Yeah. So what? Yeah. Will you explain some of the charts that you created, and we're going to link these for the listeners.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So basically, I took one deck from each faction that has done well at a tournament lately, with the exception of Stark. I pulled the Nationals list from last year just because I kind of wanted to troll this episode, partly, but also because it seems to be like the most common Stark build.
As a compliment to Nate, I mean, this.
No, I wanted to troll the episode because I pulled the Origins list rather than
the Stalag list is basically Nate's list plus like two cards. There's like a two card difference between the two, so that's a huge compliment to Nate. So.
Oh no, I agree, and yeah, Nate and I are good buds, and we talk all the time, and I'm yes. So, but I pulled it mostly because I think that that's more representative of like a Stark cost curve that's not a banner. Sure. At least that you'll see here in America.
Stark Watch is not a real Stark deck.
No, it's not.
That's okay, true.
So I ran average numbers on average character costs, including duplicates, And then I
Okay. So you're looking at the curve image first, just so...
Yes.
Just for following along purposes.
Yeah, okay. The curve image. And then I did two adjusted character curves, really, well, for all car types, really, but character is, I think, what people are really interested in. And I adjusted for duplicates once where I still counted all of the uniques into my calculation, but I only counted the unique characters once. And then in order to get my average, I just eliminated the duplicates from the deck to see how it would be if like those duplicates were in fact free and not dead cards. And not surprisingly, that curve went down dramatically. And then I did a raw character adjustment where I only counted each card by title once as a cost and then divided by all of the cards by title. And that curve matched up fairly significantly with the character count, including dupes, but it did fluctuate a little bit with some of the higher curve decks that were running 3x of big uniques. And then I... And then I ran an average on printed plot value, like the income bonus. So that was super interesting because it seemed like, obviously, the good deck builders take into account their character cost curve more than anything else and try to build a plot deck that averages out to where they can play at least a character and a location or some other card type every round, not including an income-providing location. And so, just in case anybody was wondering, I ran those average plot counts in those eight decks to an income that's averages out at 4.32 with a standard deviation of 0.7. Which is basically, it equates to a variance of about 0.49 or, you know, basically half a gold in either direction. So depending on your cost curve, you want your plots to average between 3.8, 4.3, and 4.8, depending on what kind of curve you're running.
And so I thought that 4 is the median gold that most people are shooting for.
Yeah. And most of the average plots do have about 4 gold.
I would have figured that would have skewed higher. Yeah.
No, it's about 4 gold. And I think that that's due to, the nature of locations and, events starting to go really, really cheap. You start to see now that locations, across these 8 decks that have done well have an average cost of below 1. And that's even including wall decks, because they're running so many of the zero drops and the one drops that...
I mean, that's probably skewed so much based on econ, right? I mean, not the econ available to play the locations, but the fact that the locations are econ, you know, the zero cost, Rose Roads and Ocean Roads and so on.
Yeah, so the largest non-adjusted location curves were definitely... Stark Fealty at 1.4 and Night's Watch at 1.76. But when you adjust to the raw value where you count each card type once, Stark drops a little bit to 1.4 and Night's Watch barely drops at all. So you see that those two factions rely heavily on the big four drop locations. But when you go up to their cost curve and characters, you see that they have around 3 or 3.3 at the highest with Stark, and Night's Watch is below 3 in every single category. And to me, this is what makes Night's Watch so problematic, just in general.
I think something we can infer from the plot data is that it seems like deck builders usually try to pair a number of high economy plots with a number of low, high impact plots. So like for every Valor or for every Counting Coppers, you have a high gold plot in the plot line that sort of counterbalances those numbers. And then you have a lot of just like solid utility plots at the four spot to sort of fill out the in-between. So,
and I think that also bears out in the data on if you go to the next graph, which is the cost slots by card type, you see that like in the character slot, you have an average of like 3 to 4 one drops, and that data is skewed a little bit because of Targ and Night's Watch, because Night's Watch can run up to 9 mono faction, and Targ can run up to 6 mono faction. And then you have around 8 2 drops, and then a little over 5 3 drops, 4 4 drops, 3 to 4 5 drops, 7 6 drops, and 4 7 drops. So you basically think to yourself, well, if I have 3 to 4 seven cost characters and 6 to 7 6 cost characters, I'm having 12 cards, which is a 1 in 5 chance. I definitely need to have at least a plot that I can play one of those characters without an econ location. And so I think that that's where you get that higher curve, which is where you see Bera in particular running plots that average about a 5.14. And then you get Tyrell in the traditional rush build with big guys, 5.29. Lannister is running an average of 4.29, which is exactly at the mean. But because they have such a diversified cost curve that they can run mid-range, they can run mid-max, they can do a little bit of everything, plus Tywin, they can be a little bit more flexible.
Quick question. How did Summer Harvest factor into any of this data?
So I counted every X value as 0.
Okay. So Summer Harvest, if it exists in the data, is kind of skewing it a little bit?
And in these particular builds, Summer Harvest didn't factor in, thank heavens, but Hand's Judgment did for the event costs. So Hand's Judgment...
I think reasonable research methodology.
Yeah, I just went with printed because there's absolutely no way to account for the variable situations where you'd pay 1 or 2.
Sure, yeah.
So in terms of events...
It also lines up with what ThronesDB does, which counts it as 0 as well.
Yeah, I mean, with Summer Harvest, you could take the mean cost of all plots and then just add 2, but there's the weird, like, Varys' Riddle interaction as well, but, yeah.
Or double Summer Harvest.
Indeed. Yeah.
So, in events, you have this interesting trend where every single event, right, nowadays, seems to be under 2 gold. Put to the Sword is almost entirely non-existent. Vengeance for Elia seems to be the only 2-cost event that really sees a ton of play. And I was looking at other lists that I didn't factor into this calculation, but if you look at my events, you have, generally speaking, you have about 2 0-cost events per deck, and then you have almost 9 1-cost events per deck. Yeah. And then you have 1 or fewer 2-cost events per deck. So I think that that's interesting. So if you're interested in a meta call and you want to think about Hand's Judgment, you know, 2-cost events are pretty powerful right now because it doesn't seem like people are really trying to run them.
Yep.
Yeah, lets you kind of guess how much gold you ever really need to sit on. I like that.
They could just go ahead and reprint Westeros Bleeds and have it cost 6, and then that would really skew all this data.
That actually leads me to something I was wondering about, you know, because I didn't think about it too much until I'm looking at Luke's chart here. Like, all of the other card types top out at 4 on the graph here. And, you know, when you actually stop and think about it, you're like, oh, well, that's because there just isn't anything really beyond that aside from what's the Targ location now? House of the Undying. I mean, do you guys think we will ever see any of the other card types breaking into those higher cost slots as the design of the game goes?
I hope so. I mean, I hope
the top slot of 4.
I hope they don't limit themselves to the design space of keeping them in a certain area. I mean, you obviously have to make something, the power level, you have to find like a good equilibrium between the cost and the effect, but... Yeah, I mean, hopefully they're not limited to those things. I mean, but it does seem with like the printing of House of the Undying, they've certainly dabbled. So maybe we'll eventually get an event or an attachment that costs 6 or 7.
At the same time, though, I mean, based on their own experiments, like House of the Undying, the Greyjoy event, And the Lannister event costs 3, right?
Yeah, they let you make the extra challenges.
Yeah, Lannister always pays his debts, I believe.
Yeah. Like, I think that just shows that... I mean, Lannister Pays His Debts in particular is a pretty powerful card.
Yeah.
But and in a faction that generates gold pretty easily, and still it sees close to zero play in competitive decks, I think the nature of the game and the way it's played at a competitive level is going to restrict design space unless they choose to print a card that is significantly above curve. And you actually see this with Beric, that I think that maybe they are willing to push to design space because Beric, the new Beric, his powerful reaction of the Kiss tokens, which allow him to do these infinite saves, can't be canceled, unlike Yakin, unlike House of the Undying. So maybe they are venturing in there, but they're going to have to be strong, uncancelable effects to make them, particularly on locations. I mean, events, you could do a six-card event that's massively swingy, your opponent's going to have to save 6 gold because we don't have any event cancel right now.
Brand.
Well, I think, Roy, you bring up an interesting point because it's not just about events, right? Because you see the cost curve of all of the three other card types going down, attachments, locations, and events, because people are trying to find a way to cram in big-time, huge 5, 6, and 7 cost characters in their decks. And, it's interesting because you see, like, Night's Watch and Stark and Martell don't run any 7-cost characters for the most part. And yet... Mm-hmm. The data still proves that you're running at least 4, and that's almost half of the factions not running a single character at that cost slot. And so I think that this is interesting because you get into like a discussion of setup, and it seems like a lot of the big guy decks are running mid-max curves. Like, they're running a lot of 2-drops, a lot of 6-drops, and a fair number of 7 and 1s, and then they kind of just fill in the 4s and 5s where they can and try to avoid the 3 as much as possible. Whereas some of the other decks try to go for the 3, 4, 5 range a little bit harder, and those decks seem to be suffering a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, 3 is always going to be a weird spot just because the setup number is 8. Like there's
compounded by First Snow.
Exactly. Like, yeah, it's just a weird spot.
The combination of First Snow and the fact that the econ location hits 6 or higher unique characters. And so right now the game rewards you for running 6-2 versus 5-3, which, I mean, 5-3-0, right, is a perfectly fine setup, right? And it was for a long time until First Snow hit. And, you know, but First Snow sometimes gets pushed out of the meta. But now that you have this great haul that's pushing these 6-cost characters, you want to be able to do something like 6-2-0, play a Grey Hall in the first turn, and then play another 6 or 7 cost character, right? That's like the ideal start for a lot of decks.
You know, that mentioning Great Hall actually is a good point, because I was sitting here looking at this thinking, man, that's less 5-cost characters than I was expecting. I mean, when I sit down and think about a lot of the characters that I either really want to see or am frustrated in playing against, you know, I'm looking at the Melisandres and Arianes and Ashas and so on. Like, even Giscari Elites and Barristan Selmys and stuff. Like, mentally, I've got this image that there's just like good 5-cost kind of overflowing, but they're not turning up in decks at the kind of rate I was expecting.
They are turning up in decks. They're turning up as 1x.
Yeah. Yeah, I think also...
I'm wondering if Great Hall drives people away because it's right at that cutoff where you don't get maximum benefit from Great Hall.
Also, though, like, let's be honest, though. Like, besides the core set and, like, some early cards, like Nymeria, The 5-cost slot is really weak in general, though.
Yeah, I mean, the 3-cost is as well. Like, they need to compel us...
Unless you're Stark.
Stark's to the play... Only really they need to compel us to play these cost slots.
5-cost is proportionately bad to how good their 3-drops are.
Yeah, I know, which is really frustrating, right? You and I have talked about this a lot, Luke. Like, yeah. You know, the fact that Stark has these amazing 3-cost characters, but has 2 good 5-cost characters. Well, I guess Edmure. So 3.
They have 1.5. Greywind is awesome, and Jon Snow is situationally good.
And then Edmure's fine.
I'm on the Jon Snow train. But I mean, I just think we just need to have more options, right? Like most factions have like one decent 3-cost unique character. Some have a few, but like by and large, like I can't think of many more than one for a majority of the factions. And it's just the same can mostly be said about 5, but we have so many 2-drops, so many 6-drops, so many 7s. They need to print more cards in this cost slot and really give us compelling reasons to try and play around with those slots.
Also, like, Barra's received, what, 2 5-cost? Well, there's the Corset Melisandre and then City Watch, right? Those are the only 5-cost characters that Barra has?
That's it.
Oof. Wow.
Like, again, this... Yep. I think it's in many ways because theoretically, and we saw this really in the early First Snow meta, that 5... In many ways, in a abstract sense, is the best cost slot in the game. And I feel like Nate and Danny were a little scared to push 5. Because remember the tyranny of Melisandre and Tyrion and Nymeria. Night of Flowers. In the early, in like the early part of the core and first half of the first cycle. Before First Snow. Like, First Snow changed things. You can... When the game's at its like purest, rawest stat phase of the game, that type of characters, which usually 5-cost characters usually have good strength, good effect, affordable, with a little bit of econ. And not a lot of econ, just a little bit.
Yeah, but
they haven't explored that. So.
Yeah, but I just don't know, like, and then I guess it's the sort of serpent eats its tail thing, like, maybe they're afraid to print more 3s now because First Snow exists, and that's why we don't have a lot of really solid, I mean, we got the new Theon, which is a nice addition to that cost slot, but, yeah, I'd like to see them really emphasize printing more characters in those slots and giving us a compelling reason to try and play them.
I think 3-cost slot is also interesting in that locations... are at 3-cost are non-existent unless it's Plaza of Punishment and Red Keep. I mean, Highgarden is starting to make its way out of mainstream Tyrell decks. And the cost slot itself is awkward, especially if it's not a body on the board.
Hey man, Winterfell Castle.
It's not a bad card. It's just not something that you can slot in right now.
No,
yeah, I agree, because it's expensive. Like, the tempo hit is too high. And I think the fact that you see...
It's an interesting technology card against Targ, but it's not something you're playing more than one of, and really, are you spending that slot on it? It's, yeah.
Wait, no, but I mean, like, but it still could be good, but the fact that it doesn't immediately gain you tempo or card advantage, right?
Right.
Which Plaza of Punishment can clear the board or empower other powerful cards you have. And then, of course, Red Keep draws you cards and gives you strength and power challenges.
I think Red Keep is most objectively powerful.
What we really need is a card that lets you push 3-cost locations, like something that makes them cheap, like a great haul for locations, like an event or an attachment.
House of Dreams.
Or House of Dreams, right? Yeah,
well, they have to, right? Eventually.
Eventually, right? They need something that pushes these locations, and I think you'll see more. Like, I could see if there was HOD, Winterfell Castle.
Highgarden.
HOD Highgarden. Think about this, Luke. Like, in a Targ meta, like, HOD Winterfell Castle would be pretty good, right? Because Stark has a lot of, like, if they keep a setup hit, right? Let's say you can set up, like, I don't know, 6 gold or something like that. You know, Stark has a lot of cheap characters that are good that you can run, and I think Stark would like that, right? Or the draw location, right? I think to see some of these more interesting locations pushed, they need to print cards based on
one of the other interesting things I found about locations is that the 2-cost slot across all factions is increasing rapidly.
It's probably the new income location.
It is, and I'm glad. And that's why I mentioned it, because I'm glad, because it seems like that design philosophy took root. And the average number of two-cost locations right now across the top decks, just a small sample size, is about 3.5. So you can go either way. Like, either you're just running the three incomes, or you're running, you know, two of something and two of something else. And I think that that's a good spot.
Here's where I strongly disagree with you. I think, actually, when we get to the end of this cycle, we're going to be really upset about the two-cost locations. Because, I mean, I think, like, and I said this on the first
one. Like, they won't be good, or won't like what they will have done to the meta.
What they won't have done to the meta because of the other part of what you said, Will. Because I think it makes total sense why Danny printed these, which is bestow, for it to work across all factions, not just Lannister and Tyrell.
Yeah,
you needed gold generation, right? And Danny clearly wanted bestow to work. Whether or not that's... I don't think it will have worked mostly. There's some great bestow cards like Astapor out there, but I think that what he should have done is just printed a good neutral gold producing location.
Wait, so you think that they're not powerful enough?
No. I think that it creates inequalities among factions.
Okay.
So,
because they're not all the same.
They're not on the same Starks level as like
could
Tart.
Be terrible, right? Or Tyrells could be terrible. Or because
Tyrell won't need it.
So here's
what I'm saying, Greyjoy's isn't that great, right? Well, at least right now.
I mean, but we all know the
so fantastic.
We all know the Lanny one's gonna be the best. Come on, like,
well, no. Nothing will beat the Targ. Like, the Targ is just
ridiculous. I think we already have one that's better than the Targ, but we can. Yeah, that's
the
not
the Martell one.
Yeah, the Martell one is also really good. Like the these are just so, like, when they're good, they're so above the curve that it's going to be a problem.
So my complaint with this, it goes to a higher sort of issue in that if the problem to me isn't that the disparity between the power levels of the cards themselves, but rather the way that the printing cycle works, that some factions have access to them so much earlier than others, that even if they were all equal, if they were divvying them out in such a way, like, Targ had access to theirs through the entirety of, like, the regional season and nationals and so on, and presumably, you know, Stark, Lanny, Barra, Tyrell, they're not going to get theirs until – so they might not even get them by Gen Con. We don't know if the fifth pack is going to be ready in time for Gen Con. And so that's a bigger problem to me than the actual sort of – the disparity between
– You need to talk to Ruben from the Netherlands. He is, like – so adamant that they should release blocks at a time.
I agree with Ruben and I agree with Alex, but I think excluding that, though, the fact that some of these cards are going to fail, like, it's just the way card design works, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then
the Greyjoy one.
And then they just, but the problem is,
I don't think the Greyjoy one's that bad.
Right.
I'll put money down now that it's the worst one by the end of the.
Because we don't know, right? But we don't know. We don't know Barra, Tyrell.
I think it's too conditional. Like, I've played the, like, Greyjoy Lion Mill deck, and it's awesome in that deck. But outside of that, it's not. It's too slow.
Yeah. Greyjoy is so much better.
Yeah. I mean, but
I do want to. Oh, sorry.
It's a permanent structural weakness, right?
Yeah.
And the problem was Nate when
this
he designed.
Night's Watch is a problem.
Yeah. Well, Night's Watch. Not Night's Watch. I'm sorry. Nate. There we go. It's a different N word. Nate. Wow. Nate designed the core set of the first edition to be balanced around economy. And you've now printed cards that break that, but you haven't printed them equal among factions. And so that creates a natural disparity that is permanently going to impact the long-term growth of the game. And I think the fact that the rich get richer is going to be a big, big problem. And I think that's I have no problem with a card game not being balanced around gold. Like, it's one of the things that I liked about first edition was it wasn't really balanced around economy, but that's the way in which cards like Tywin and Robert and all these other kind of cards were balanced, but they're increasingly not going to be. And so the easiest way to win in second edition is going to be what we affectionately in my playgroup call bullshit decks, which are, you know, like Lanny Reigns is the ultimate example of this. Like, decks that just play
big
good characters and just play them. You read set the board, well, I have five more, play. Yeah, I win. It doesn't matter. Like, it creates a much higher skill floor and a mut, you know, then
to create a counterpoint. Do you think that if they were all the same, like say they all just tapped for two gold or whatever, do you think that Martell would be seeing the sort of resurgence that it's been seeing in the last few weeks with a lot of the Martell fealty decks that we're seeing pop up across the world? I mean, I don't. I think the fact that the Martell one is like far and away better than the Greyjoy one. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, they really needed that. So,
well, I mean,
I would agree.
Here's where I disagree. Like, I think Martell wants the economy. And I think because Martell's themes right now in many ways are being held back by the lack of economy and the lack of draw, right? And the current – the two cost locations –
the draw is coming.
Both problems solved.
Both problems are going to be solved. Yep. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah, but then in order to play this card, the fiefdoms, you have to play a bunch of high initiative plots, which a lot of times have low reserve. And so good luck keeping all your tricks.
I don't know. I'll play Varys's Riddle and Fallen from Favor and –
Yes, I mean, sure. But,
like, again, I'm always welcome to be wrong. Like, I don't mind. I never mind being wrong about Thrones. But I think it's something I noticed with the first chapter pack and the way in which Bestow works and Dany's decision to make Bestow the central theme of the cycle and what it means to the economy instead of, like, finding other ways to empower Bestow or for Bestow to work differently, like over time, like you can pay an additional gold later to give a benefit or something. It creates this weird thing, and I think it's going to massively, in the long term, flood the gold and the rich. Like, you know, it's sadly going to be unlike how inflation works in real life, which is the rich are going to get richer rather than, you know, inflation devaluing currency. But anyway,
Will, can I just say that? Like, I know we're kind of, we're at an hour and 17 minutes, so I want to kind of bring it back. I haven't gotten to listen to the new player episode. I'm excited to.
Okay.
But I think that a lot of the discussion we've been into is really, really valuable for both new and veteran players, but, like, specifically to get into the new player stuff. I think that, like, the spine of the deck has kind of, It's been relatively consistent, but I think that it's starting to really solidify. Like, if you want to run just a generally good faction with good cards, I think you run, judging by the numbers that I ran, you run plots that equate to about 4.5 gold as an average, and then you run 32 characters, you run 5 attachments, and that puts you at 37 cards. And then I think you run between 9 and 10 locations, and then 8 to 9 events, depending on how you distribute the locations. That just seems to be the sweet spot of these winning decks.
Yeah, I think there's a very real template here that it has been established.
Yeah, I'm excited for all that to get shaken up.
Me too. Can I explain why I think Night's Watch breaks the game?
Sure.
Okay, so
it's
another 45-minute topic.
It's not that long. Like, if you look at the cost curves, they're the lowest cost curve at almost every major statistical category except for locations.
Location.
And even if you factor that into their character cost, locations are still generally cheaper than characters as a whole. So they have the lowest cost curve on average, yet a really stunning, like, qualification and win ratio. And, like, they don't have to care about big characters and economy because they have a couple really great economy, and they don't have to care about cards, and they don't have to care about draw because they have amazing draw that's consistent. That's great for setup too, and for claim soak. I honestly, like, what was the most stunning revelation for me, and, you know, as much as I'm loath to admit it, I think that, like, that Joe's dance deck was just, like, the perfect meta call, because First Snow of Winter is just insane, because if you look at, like, Stark, Targ, Martell, and Night's Watch all have adjusted cost curves at below 3.5.
You know what's really funny, Luke?
Yeah.
You and I draw absolutely opposite conclusions based on Joe's dance deck. like, I look at Night's Watch and I say, this is an interesting faction that's shaking up the way the game is played. And I look at both the cost curve of Joe's deck and then I having seen Joe's deck in action firsthand, it's what's wrong with this game, which is that – and even the way Joe and his very piffy tournament report says, which is
– I have Joe's deck's numbers, and it's actually pretty balanced across all of the cost slots.
Right, but basically its game plan is play a big dude, win challenges with a big dude, play a second big dude, win challenges with a big dude.
Oh, I don't disagree with you whatsoever.
So
I actually
that's what I think is the long-term problem with the game. I agree. I want to play cool characters like Tywin, but when I play a cool character like Tywin or the Mountain, I feel like I'm bullshitting the game.
Shitty when I marshal a Shadow Tower Mason and load him up with 2 1-drop attachments, and I defend for 12 strength.
I feel good when I do that.
See, that's not
fun. When you attack with Tywin and I still win, that feels really good.
See, that doesn't feel good to me, and I also don't feel good attacking with Tywin, so it's fine.
So there we go.
So they're both horrible for the game.
No, I think it's a recency thing. Like the Night's Watch, if Night's Watch wins Gen Con and then is also a bit major player at Worlds, I mean, you know, that's going to get slightly annoying, but the onus is on us as deck builders and designers and players to solve that meta. And I think the answers are out there. We just have to, you know, you just have to find the balance between beating the Night's Watch deck and beating the big dumb guy decks. And I just, you know, people just need to get creative. And the more cards they print, I personally am not in a place where I believe we need a restricted list or anything like that. I think the meta's healthy. I think there are decks on the horizon that might not be healthy, but you know, we need to try and find ways to beat these boogeymen, so to speak. And I think that exists.
Played against the Night's Watch Summer Builders deck?
I've played it a lot. I've played against it as well. I have a few extremely hard counters to the deck.
But how much do they – I mean, well, this is a totally different discussion. I guess my problem with Night's Watch is that, like, one of the fundamental design philosophies of second edition is that, like you said earlier, Roy, is to balance it around economy and to balance it around big dumb idiots and then to limit draw. And Night's Watch does none of that shit.
and here's the thing, though, and we're going to get on this. That's what makes Night's Watch awesome. Like, I love the Builder's deck. The Builder's deck does something. We should get off this. We should move on to Pop Traps and Slops because we've run this in the ground. But I think Darren, I can't remember if it was Darren or Darren Hazelton or Joshua Chambers, said this in the discussion of Wama's deck. And for the Builder's deck is an amazing experience to play. And if you hate the Builder's deck, I really, really recommend that you play it because every single thing you do with that deck is a decision that has a meaningful impact on not just plot. If you make a decision on plot 1, it has meaningful impact on plot 5.
Yeah,
meaningful impact. Now,
yeah, it's not an autopilot deck at all.
It could be definitely. MPE for the person you're playing against, but to play that deck because it has a clear game plan that you need to execute to the top of your skill level, whatever it is. And I would say, I think with that deck, I'm probably better than a lot of people, but I'm still nowhere near a top-tier player. You know, I constantly, though, when I play that deck, I feel like I need to play to my optimum. There's no, like, if I make a mistake...
I'll never play that deck.
I need to, you know, that's on me. And I can definitely, and Luke has listened to me talk about my successes and failures with that deck. You know, it's a deck that you learn immediately the mistakes you've made. And I think other decks that exist out there, Lannister Tyrell and some Tyrell decks exist that don't have that. And that's what makes Builders and other Night's Watch decks, the Stark Watch as well. They're just, you have to play the game well and in a different way than the way in which the game wants you to. And that's what makes them so appealing to me and why I'm excited about where Night's Watch is right now. And I do agree with Alex, even though I'm very harsh right now on the game and some aspects of it, I actually think the meta is actually in a really interesting place in an overall, like, in a meta sense. Like, to talk about the meta, to think about the meta, it's in one of its healthiest places. There's a variety of different archetypes, archetypes, however you want to pronounce it, that work, and they interplay with each other really well, and you can really, if you can get a read on the meta of a tournament, and this is something that Seth did, and it's the same up in Euros, the two recent really large tournaments, and Joe recently did a dance with his decision to be so heavy and all in on tiers, is if you can read the meta really well, you can have a lot of success. And that, I think, is really good for the game in the long term, particularly compared, again, to where we were before Gen Con last year, which was just Lanny Dragon and Stark Fealty, right?
Yeah.
And...
Well, Lanny Banner anything. Really.
Yeah, but Lanny Dragon. Like, let's be honest here. Like, Lanny Dragon. Like, it was better than any of the other banners, right?
And maybe, yeah, I mean, Kraken had a plus matchup against that deck, but then it kind of didn't do well against some of the other stuff.
So. Yeah, actually, I think the Lanny Wolf deck was possibly the best, like, Lanny mirror match deck, but it just had bad matchups in other places where the dragon didn't.
Well, that's, and then that was Joe's Metacarful Worlds, right? Which was that I predict I'm going to run into way more Lannister than I'm running into anything else, and what will win the Lannister mirror? Lanny Wolf. And that's what he did. That's, and then he high rolled his way through the cut. So that, and that's the problem. Like, I think that's the problem that the deck, that the meta was in a year ago, or not, even a year and a half ago, to go to Worlds, right? And I think high rolling your way up into success in this game is way lower than it was before. I think the skill cap of the game overall is higher, and that's really exciting and one of the things I'm loving about second edition right now.
Agreed.
Yeah, I'm totally with you, but builders are still stupid.
strong disagree. Strong disagree.
We're going to head right back down that same alley unless I make a move now. So, dear listeners, we're going to post those images in Excel files so you can view them along with the episode. Let us know what other kind of observations you have from taking a look at some of these stats. In other news, props and slops.
Yeah. I got some props.
All right. Lay it on us.
Props to all the American players who are making the trek out to Stalic this year. Sadly, I cannot be one of them, but I'm really happy that a lot of top-level players are going, and just a lot of players in general. It's definitely something I think that... the Americans have been chomping at the bit to get their hands on that Stalic trophy, so hopefully we can usurp the throne. And I know there's been a lot of trash talk, specifically from Bamford, about how the Americans have a competitively hollow meta, I believe, is what he keeps saying.
Well, I mean, I think Alex, I don't know. Did you play in 2015?
I did not. I was not a Thrones player.
So you know what that joke... So just to be clear to newer players...
Is he joking? Yeah.
Specific thing. So
I have no context whatsoever.
I'll briefly tell the story. So, because this was like right when I started playing hardcore competitively. So when Dave Bamford became English champion in 2015, Seth Lowe went on what was then the predominant Facebook group and really gave Dave a hard time for running to 61 card deck, I believe. Okay. And Craven was running a 63 card deck, I think, and he came in top four at English Nationals. And he and like Seth hammered the two of them about that their decks and were not 60 cards, were not competitively viable, and that the English meta must be competitively hollow. Okay. This created what's known as Sethgate. At the time.
Fair enough.
All right. Will remembers this, right? And
I've had my history lesson then.
And so that was Bamford loving, well, semi-affectionately ribbing Seth for that long-term slight. I think it made Bamford quite happy.
All the more, I think it's good that we have like a competitive aspect between, you know, continents. Oh, yeah.
And like, if you listen to the last episode of Banter, like Dave will not play 60 cards. Like, he'll play 61.
Yep.
Yeah. That's 100% Seth. That's a legacy of Seth.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. No, so that's my props. Props to the players going over there. I'm really excited for them and would love to help some if there's a testing process post Worlds or even pre Worlds for that. I'd love to be a part of it. And I was going to say
the Americans. It better be pre Worlds.
Yeah.
I think I would not be surprised to build on that, Alex.
Yeah.
Chris Schoenthal knows I love him, that we wouldn't see Ryan Jones be solid champion. Like, Ryan is a beast.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that man.
Yeah, dude, my crowning achievement this competitive season was beating Ryan Jones in Joust.
Yeah, and that's a huge accomplishment. I mean, Ryan is very similar, I think, like Tom Malucci, Seth Lowe.
Tom's going as well, and my boy Johnny Wright.
I know Tom's going.
Nice.
I'm thinking about people who are like Swiss masters who never
seem to.
Chris Thompson, yeah, he's another good one, who never seem to like flag in Swiss. There's a lot of other good players that I can think of. Like, I won't name names because myself included in this. I'm not good. That flag a little bit in Swiss, they lose some of their energy towards the middle rounds. But people like Ryan, people like Tom, Chris don't lose energy, and then they can really push through these big tournaments. And you know, they'll be able to compete with people like Tomas, right? Who are these like amazing European Swiss masters, and I'm really actually looking forward to following
Florian.
Florian, yeah.
We could talk about players all night, I'm sure. Yeah.
Ugh. Oh yeah.
But and slops, man. I don't know if I have any slops. Slops to not knowing what packs are going to be available for Gen Con yet. I guess that's probably my biggest slops right now. So.
I thought you were going to slap me for sure, Alex.
No, man. I totally respect what you had to say. So, yeah, that's me. You guys?
Props. I'll do a props. Props to my wife and me moving into a new home.
Congratulations.
Dude.
It's our first house that we bought together, so, yeah.
Congratulations, man.
Yeah, congrats.
Are you an indie guy? Are you in Indianapolis area, Luke?
I am now, but I don't consider myself an indie guy by birth.
Okay. Fair enough. Yeah.
The Kentuckian.
Yeah.
Yeah, listen to that accent.
Is it really that strong? I don't think
it's not
that
strong. It really isn't.
Clearly you're from the real South, not Indianapolis.
You know, Roy is one of the bare handful of people I could hear actually say that sentence and it not be derogatory. Well done.
Slobster Roy.
I was complimenting you in particular, Luke.
Oh, like, I thought that you were trying to make it. Okay.
Yeah, no, I meant that Roy didn't mean it derogatorily. But almost anyone else that said that, it would be,
there's the Kentuckian in you right there, which, you know.
Exactly.
You know, we could go into Southern identity politics. For the pros and cons of it for a long time, but
or we could not.
Right, this is the West Coaster.
Yeah, West Coaster. Fake America.
Hey, don't put me in a box, man.
You know, anything. I'm from the Old Dominion, right? Which is the oldest part of the United States.
Kentucky was part of the Old Dominion.
I was about to get there, Luke. I was about to get there. You get to be an honorary Virginian. All right, by being part of the Commonwealth of Kentucky, which you
proposed to my wife in Virginia. How about that?
Which is you know, Kentucky is you inherited your terrible land policy from Virginia, among other things. Oof. But anyway, so I want to slop land policy and county structure in the state, in the great state of Kentucky, because it's terrible.
The great Commonwealth.
That's important.
And I also want to slop. So actually, all right. So this episode is going to air the first week in July, right? Right after July 4th.
Let me see.
No, I guess it won't be. It'll be the
last. No, this one will be the 30th. Yeah,
it'll be the 30th. So literally on the 30th, Al and I will be moving her stuff into our new apartment. So I'm 100% slopping that experience in advance. Just 100%. Just saying.
Yeah, slops to moving. I mean, there's a good aspect to it, but the actual moving process is awful.
Terrible. I'm really excited. It's a really nice apartment. I'm really excited to be with Al. And I get off this building Wi-Fi, which would be really nice. I have some plans for some online Thrones content once I have a good online...
Some plans.
Plans. I have plans. But anyway, I want to prop the GameStop employee today, who when Al and I just decided to stop by GameStop to check it out, and we idly asked if they had a Switch, called another store in our area and got and convinced them to hold a Switch, one of the few Switches. I think it was the last one that they had. Al, was it the last one that they had? It was the last Switch that they had, the last Switch in the Philadelphia area for us, and we drove out and bought a Nintendo Switch today. So I want to prop that GameStop employee, who will never hear this, but I'm sending it into the cosmos. You are a good person that broke company policy and convinced another GameStop employee to break company policy to hold that Switch for us.
The last Switch.
Wow.
The last Switch in Philly.
Yeah, the last Switch in Philly, which we now own. And I'm quite excited to watch Ella play Zelda.
I have props to all the sports fans out there. Props to the Las Vegas Gold Knights, who had their expansion draft tonight and have an actual roster now.
Oh, boy. I can't wait to see that, what that looks like.
Well, this isn't even the regular draft, and they got Marc-Andre Fleury from the Penguins, and they got James Neal from the Predators, so...
Fair enough.
Yeah. Not the worst thing ever.
Oh, one final thing, I'm sorry, that I want to prop. I want to prop everyone who came to Dance with Dragons 2, which was a huge success. As of this recording, it's still the largest regional in North America. Who knows, it may be suppressed.
Indy's going to be it.
Maybe. I don't put it past Indy.
We had 58 last year.
Yeah, but we had 77 in Boonton, so I'm just saying.
We'll get there.
I don't doubt it. Like, Chris is a great organizer. He does great promotion. I don't know what role are you playing in the Indy Regional, Luke? Are you playing or are you organizing?
Future champion.
Both.
So I'm sure you guys do a great job. I honestly don't doubt it. But I really want to prop everyone who came out. I really appreciate it. I hope you had a really great experience. It was really fun for me, despite some nonsense of leaking pipes and torrential downpours. We had a really great time. It proved to me that what you really need to do in these tournaments is get through everything by like 7 o'clock, and then you can begin an early after party that finishes up around like 1 a.m., and then still like 5 hours of partying. So it's not like 4 a.m. like Red Saturday last year, which I want to slop.
Ooh.
Getting to Staten Island by like 4:30 a.m. and then having to get up at like 8 to drive is not fun. So slops to getting in late and getting up early, but props to still getting huge amounts of partying in, but being done at a reasonable hour, which proves I'm old.
That was the worst prop ever.
Is it a prop that's in the danger zone, Luke?
Oh, but wait, I wanted to prop Alamo Draft House. Oh, well.
You know what's really good about Alamo Draft House? It's a great place to close chapters of books.
I think it's a terrible place to read. Terrible.
It has really well
way too dim.
The movies are so loud. I close the chapter you were reading.
that's fair.
I actually find their lobby, the lobby of the couple of Alamo Draft House that I've been in, very well lit. That's all I'm saying.
Hey, props to Alex coming on last minute.
Yeah, no problem.
Yes.
Yes, thank you, Alex.
Happy to be here as always. Yeah, it's a first for me.
Yeah, at this rate, we're going to wind up drafting you permanently in about 6 months, just like normally happens to everyone else,
whenever
like
one of the
Luke and Roy.
Just quits the game.
Yeah.